is like this.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the February 16, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. My name is Karen Wheeler, and today we will be reading the following main articles. Australia declares koalas an endangered species. Written by Manan Luthra for the Science section of the New York Times. Secrets from zoo polar bears could help conservation efforts in the wild. Written by Maggie Galloway for Popular Science. And, of course, if we have time, following up with miscellaneous articles. First up, Australia declares koalas an endangered species. Years of drought, fires, and habitat loss have drastically reduced the population of the iconic marsupial. By Manan Luthra for the Science section of the New York Times. The Australian government on Friday declared the koala an endangered species as drought, bushfires, disease, and habitat loss have drastically reduced the numbers of an animal that is an emblem of the country's unique wildlife. The announcement by the country's environment minister came 2 years after a parliamentary inquiry predicted that koalas could be extinct by 2050 without urgent government intervention. Reclassification from vulnerable to endangered does not require the Australian government to take any special action, but it separately announced that it would adopt a recovery plan for the koala issued by the country's environmental department. That plan would aid the creation of laws protecting koalas and their natural woodland habitats. Additionally, Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced last month that the government would commit $50 million Australian dollars, $35.7 million American, over 4 years to koala recovery and conservation efforts. The plight of the koala gained global attention in 2019 when bushfires raged over millions of acres in Australia, blackening the animal's habitats. A report commissioned by the World Wildlife Fund Australia estimated that 60,000 koalas had been killed, injured, or affected in some way. In response, the Australian government committed 18 million Australian dollars to be split between restoring the koala's habitats and investing in koala health research. In 2020, World Wildlife Fund Australia, the International Fund for Animal Welfare, and the Humane Society International collectively nominated the animal for listing as an endangered species. The groups found that koala populations in the states of Queensland and New South Wales had decreased by 50% or more since 2001. It's unclear how many koalas remain. Efforts to count the animals, which are continuing, have proven extremely difficult. While the animal welfare groups welcomed the Australian government's actions announced on Friday, others said that key problems, specifically land clearing, deforestation, and resulting habitat loss, had been neglected. Deborah Tabbert, chairwoman of the Australian Koala Foundation, said the animal's new status, quote, doesn't mean anything. The federal government, she added, quote, may be offering our koalas a nice new word, but behind all the photo opportunities and political rhetoric, they continue to approve the destruction of the koala habitat. If the clearing of koala habitat continues, Ms. Tabbert said, a further status change is imminent, from endangered to extinct. Secrets from zoo polar bears could help conservation efforts in the wild. Bears in captivity provide researchers with more accessibility and data than those in the wild. By Maggie Galloway. Growing up to 8 feet long and 1,700 pounds, polar bears are the largest carnivorous land mammals on the planet. Researchers have long tried to understand these enigmatic apex predators, but most wild polar bears live in hard-to-reach habitats above the Arctic Circle. Luckily, scientists don't have to go all the way to the North Pole to find a polar bear, because chances are they can be seen at your local zoo. While these bears kept in captivity might primarily be there for entertainment and education, much to the dismay of animal rights groups, a collective of scientists wants to study them to help save their wild brethren from the threats such as rising temperatures. Since 2018, the Polar Bear Research Council, or PBRC, in partnership with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, AZA, Species Survival Plan, has studied polar bears in captivity to help conserve them in the wild. On January 26, the PBRC published its 2022 Polar Bear Research Master Plan, which outlines ongoing research and the Council's goals moving forward. Zoos can provide researchers greater accessibility to polar bears to amass far more data than conducting studies out in the remote regions of the Arctic, according to Terry Roth, co-chair of the PBRC Steering Committee and Vice President of Conservation at the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden. Wild polar bears mostly dwell in Alaska, Russia, Canada, Greenland, and Norway, where climates are harsh for humans. Their solitary lifestyle, strength, ferocity, and discomfort around humans can make it difficult or dangerous for polar bear researchers. While studying polar bear populations in the wild provides invaluable insights, expeditions are expensive and have less frequent observations. But zoos offer a convenient and data-rich alternative. Scientists can readily access bears' full medical history and monitor their behavior 24/7 over many years. It's an amazing opportunity to collect detailed data and biological samples that are only going to be collected hit or miss with wild bears, Roth says. Obviously, bears in captivity are very different from wild bears, and this is something that researchers must take into account. However, Roth says the differences between the two populations can also be used as an advantage. Captive polar bears can also actually serve as somewhat of a control population, depending on what you're looking for, she says. For example, Roth and her colleagues have considered looking at wild polar bears' exposure to certain toxins and pollutants while using some zoo bears as a control population to see what a normal baseline would look like without exposure. However, zoos often need guidance in deciding which studies to pursue, Roth adds. Often it's challenging for zoos to decide which research projects they would participate in. We get inundated with requests and our staff only have so much time, Roth explains. The research report acts as a third-party guide to help zoos prioritize research that the council identified as most needed in the field, Roth says. The PBRC reviews proposals from scientists and endorses the projects that address most essential areas of research, such as in-field polar bear monitoring and management techniques, physiological and behavioral ecology, and reproduction. Zoos are more likely to participate in studies endorsed by the PBRC. One such study is the Project Burr on Fur, an initiative between Polar Bears International, a supporting organization of the PBRC, and 3M to develop new technology for tracking polar bears in the wild. Currently, satellite collars that go around the neck of the polar bear are the most commonly used tracking technology. These devices allow researchers to collect data on wild polar bears' movements and activities, such as how long they swim. However, the collars can only be placed on adult females, excluding males and juveniles from the data pool. Adult males' necks are larger than their heads. They're basically cone-shaped, and the collars fall off very easily, says Jeff York, the Senior Director of Conservation for Polar Bears International. The researchers also can't collar juveniles because they would outgrow the collars too quickly. There are also indigenous groups in the Arctic that view these collars as disrespectful. Ear tags are another method of tracking wild bears, but those require punching a hole in their ear. The tags are hard to remove without injuring the bear, York explains. To solve these issues, PBI and 3M developed several burr-on-fur satellite trackers that could attach to the fur of the polar bear, such as how a plant burr clings onto clothes or animal coats. This way the tracker doesn't harm the polar bear and can also stick onto polar bears of any size. So far, researchers have deployed 17 tags on wild bears in the Hudson Bay region in Canada and tested them with polar bears from 9 different zoos. The most successful tracker so far is the Tri-Brush tag, a triangular tracker with edges like a spiral notebook. Inside the spiral is essentially a pipe cleaner, says York. With our burr, we can tangle up the fur, push that down onto the back of the bear so it's nice and snug. Polar bears in captivity are a great test case to determine how long the trackers will stay on, according to York, because they are more keenly aware of disturbances. Polar bears in zoos have fewer distractions, so they're much more likely to know there's something on their back and decide if they want to do something to try to get it off, he says. The Tri-Brush tags stayed on captive polar bears for about 14 days, and on wild polar bears, about 52 days on average, York says. While Polar Bears International would like to get about 6 months of use out of these trackers, York says there's still a lot of data to be gleaned from 52 days, and they're still prototyping and adjusting the designs. There's really a lot of good science going on with wildlife zoos, and people don't usually think of that when they think of their local zoo, Terry Roth says. It's a really good opportunity to learn about these species in ways that we can't by studying wild populations. As rabies pops up in the north again this year, researchers look to predict future outbreaks. Warnings have been issued in several communities this winter in Canada where infected foxes or dogs have been seen. Written by Paul Tucker for the Environment Desk at Canadian Broadcasting News. Susan Tulugarjuk was walking to work in Iglukik one morning in December when she felt something bite the back of her leg. I looked back, and there was a fox, she recalled. It attacked me from the back. I didn't see it. The bite itself wasn't too bad, but the bigger concern was rabies. It's been a banner year for rabies in Canada's Arctic, with infected foxes showing up in several communities. Dogs have been attacked and sometimes killed. Health officials have been issuing regular warnings to communities. Last week, people in Tiktoyaktuk in Northwestern Territories were cautioned about two dogs that showed signs of rabies. Tulugarjuk got her shots. The disease is, quote, virtually 100% fatal if untreated, according to the World Health Organization. Today, Tulukarjuk's recovered, but the whole thing has left her a little spooked. I started bringing a stick with me every time I go out, just in case, you know, she says. I started getting scared of dogs, and I'm not usually scared of them. Rabies is not new in the Arctic. Documented cases go back decades, but many researchers are now working to predict the periodic peaks in infection, like this winter's outbreak in Nunavut. It's something that's enzootic, so it's always present in Arctic fox populations, said Brian Stevens, a wildlife pathologist for the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative. He's based in Ontario, and the Nunavut government referred questions to him instead of a local biologist. We see these cycles of outbreaks where there seems to be a higher prevalence of the virus in population, Stevens said. Typically, local outbreaks happen on a 10 to 15 year cycle, he said, with some outbreaks more severe than others. This is nothing new, said Ben Kovic, who was a Nunavut conservation officer for more than 20 years and also served as chair of the Nunavut Wildlife Management Board. Kovic grew up in Coral Harbor on Southampton Island, where most of his family and the other families he knew were fox trappers. There wasn't much else to trap around there, he says. There was no wolverine, no wolf, no beaver, nothing except for fox, he said. Even though rabies would pop up every so often, it wasn't a big deal, according to Kovic. People knew how to recognize it and avoid infected animals. It was rare for a person to get infected, he said. The only thing we heard of was the occasional dog, husky, you know, will get rabies, he said. Kovic, who lives in Iqaluit, is not sure whether this year's rabies outbreak is more severe than most. He wonders if people in Nunavut's capital city are just a little more sensitive to it. Everybody's concentrating on fox sightings, worried about this, worried about that. It gets to be the only thing people are talking about, he said. Still, Stevens and other wildlife researchers suggest there may be a general boom in Canada's Arctic fox population this winter, and therefore more rabid foxes. Fox numbers cycle up and down through the years, and according to Kovic, a boom year for a prey species like lemmings or voles is usually followed by a spike in the fox population, but there could also be another factor that's not well understood, and that makes predictive models a little more complicated. Climate change is really going to affect the Arctic fox rabies dynamics, said Dr. Emily Jenkins, a professor of veterinary microbiology at the University of Saskatchewan. She's been studying Arctic foxes at Karak Lake near Cambridge Bay, Nunavut, for years. Foxes tend to roam across the polar region, and that's how rabies gets around. Infection is fatal in most animals, though there's new evidence that some Arctic foxes survive an infection. A lull period for rabies is one part of the Arctic that might end when an infected fox wanders over the sea ice from somewhere else, sparking a new local outbreak. But as sea ice diminishes in the Arctic, foxes may not be able to roam as freely or as far, according to Jenkins. Different populations might become more isolated. I guess it's kind of good news if there's less sea ice and less connectivity of Arctic fox populations. We may see less rabies overall because it won't be able to spread around the world every couple of years and flare up if populations are more isolated, Jenkins said. The flip side is that diminished sea ice means Arctic foxes are more landlocked and so more likely to wander near people and dogs. This could be another factor happening this year. If Arctic fox populations are not out on sea ice and they're coming closer to communities, we may see more rabies if it does get into a population. There's also another wild card factor that makes predictions about Arctic rabies difficult, the red fox. That species has been making its way further north into traditional Arctic fox territory, and the implications are not yet clear. Jenkins says it's probably not good for Arctic foxes. Wild canids don't tolerate each other very well, and they will compete for the same prey, and they will actively kill each other. The red fox would, quote, probably be a good host for rabies in the north, she says, though they're less likely to wander across sea ice and spread infection to other regions. Jenkins believes it would be valuable to be able to predict rabies outbreaks in the north so that people and communities have an early warning. That way they can ensure their dogs are vaccinated, that children know how to recognize infected animals, and how to be cautious. She also points out that in Europe, some wild red foxes are orally vaccinated against rabies using bait, something to be considered around northern communities, she says, to create a buffer of vaccinated foxes when rabies is widespread. Researchers are now developing predictive models for outbreaks. But the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic has thrown a wrench in a lot of wildlife research. Jenkins would typically spend summers on Nunavut collecting data at Karak Lake to track animals' exposure to disease over time. She's been unable to go north for the last 2 years, and the upcoming fieldwork season is also in question, she says. It means we lose some of our ability to track changes over time, which is, of course, one of the bigger questions about the Arctic, especially the Western Canadian Arctic, which is undergoing climate change at about 3 times the global rate, Jenkins said. When you're looking at changes over time and you miss a few years, well, that's a big data gap, unfortunately. And now a short item from National Wildlife Magazine's February-March 2022 issue, Program Spotlight, Protecting and Restoring Coastlines. As climate change worsens, our nation's shorelines are bearing the brunt of its devastating effects, including rising tides, stronger storms, and increased flooding. These weather events and climate disasters cause billions of dollars of damage annually. In response to these significant challenges, National Wildlife Federation developed the Coastal Resilience Growth Fund to build capacity for funding multiple projects at a regional scale. To coordinate implementation, the National Wildlife Federation employs a variety of tactics on local and federal levels to restore and protect vulnerable coastal areas. The Coastal Resilience Growth Fund strategy follows a 3-tiered approach, working at the federal level to improve coastal protection policy, working on the ground to assess sites and carry out coastal resilience solutions such as planting seagrasses, constructing oyster beds, and creating living shorelines, and prioritizing environmental justice to ensure that frontline communities who are most affected can access these solutions. We're seeding multiple projects to build our capacity, says Chris Hilke, National Wildlife Federation's Director of Coastal Resilience in the Northeast region. Our approach will ensure landscape-scale regional impact versus completing one project at a time. Successful resilience projects have included the Great Marsh in Massachusetts, where National Wildlife Federation worked with several partners to restore the marsh and nearby dunes, resulting in healthier fish and wildlife habitat and a stronger buffer against coastal storms and other climate disasters. Thank you for joining us for the Environment Program. My name is Karen Wheeler.